Hi, I'm Kyra Kellawan, an international educator with experience of careers and college counselling in schools and universities across four countries. You're listening to the Piloted Podcast, a show about innovation in education for teachers, parents, and students. Hi, and welcome back to episode 4 of the Piloted Podcast. In this week's episode, I'm talking to Shira Walsh, who is a Toronto-based educator, mother, and special needs advocate who founded a workshop called Grey Matters. Grey Matters brings the concept of an inclusive classroom to life by helping students understand how the brain functions. As a teacher, she introduced this first with her own classes, stopping all regular learning to focus 1 week a year on learning about the brain. Now, leading workshops in schools all across Toronto and the Ontario region, she's teaching students about the nervous system and the amazing capacity for change that the brain has, also known as neuroplasticity. She involves daily speakers who have diverse brains themselves, sometimes students of a similar age to the children, sometimes adults, and her goal is to build inclusion for her students who have both visible and invisible disabilities. After 7 years of being a classroom teacher in primary schools, Shira had a daughter with an incredibly rare and severe neurological disorder. I started out by asking Shira how Grey Matters had come about.
I started Grey Matters as an organization, I guess, for two reasons. First is I had a need. I had a need for more flexibility than a regular classroom teaching job would offer me. And I thought the idea of doing workshops was ideal. My daughter just has so many appointments and medical and therapy appointments that I couldn't commit to the classroom full time. But the reason I did Grey Matters and I'm choosing to address the idea of neurodiversity is because A, I have a daughter who's neurologically diverse in many ways. And B, it was an issue that I felt isn't addressed in our curriculum at all. And I had run workshops like this in my own classroom, and I saw the need for them and the impact that teaching kids about the brain and how it works and how sometimes it works differently. I saw how impactful that could be on their understanding of one another and acceptance of one another. So that's why I started this. I originally had actually been doing workshops in schools for a different company that wasn't my own. And it just was feeling, I mean, it wasn't meaningful to me. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't go and teach kids about something that I didn't care about. Not if I was going to take time away from my daughter who needs me more than most kids, I guess, need their adults. So that's why I started this. I wanted to make sure if I was doing something, it was important and meaningful and that I was filling a void, because this stuff, it isn't in most curriculums and it is so important to talk about.
So tell me a little bit about Brain Week, which is something I read you pulled together with your own students back in the classroom. How did you choose what you were going to feature each week?
So Brain Week was 1 week of like full day programming all about the brain. Quite honestly, it varied year to year based on my students' needs, based on what they needed to learn about. I found if some classes just like they were lacking the resilience, like they gave up easily, or they didn't have the growth mindset, which is the word, I don't know if it's there, but in Canada and the US, that is the word of now. They lacked a growth mindset. And so I found that teaching them about the idea of neuroplasticity was a way to really make them understand. And it wasn't just a teacher saying, I believe in you, you can do anything, because they just say, yeah, of course you do, you're a teacher. But saying like, here's the science behind it. I'm not full of it. Like this is real, and you actually can do anything, but you have to work really hard at it. You have to change sometimes how you learn or your approach to learning, and it's possible. So sometimes I would focus more on neuroplasticity. Other times it would be more on neurodiversity if there were kids who were being left out, for example, because of their neurological differences. So the year I started it was when I had a student with autism. And he was in grade 2, and the kids were starting to notice that he was getting privileges and certain exceptions. He didn't have to follow the rules in the same way they did. And because they didn't know that he was on the spectrum, it just seemed unfair to them, and that made sense. So once they understood that you know, every kid is different and every kid in person has different needs, then they could understand that, you know, we don't treat every kid equally, but we treat them equitably. We say, you get what you need, and what every kid needs is different.
This is with second graders.
It started with second graders. Yeah. And a lot of teachers actually ask, like, you know, this clearly sounds like appropriate for middle school. And I feel like there's no age too young to teach kids that, you know, we're all different, but we all deserve to get what we need in light of these differences.
So you had support from your school district, I'm guessing, to be able to incorporate this. How much time did it take you to make sure that you could include it? And what were your learnings? Would you kind of be able to help other teachers out who would like to do something similar, but maybe don't have the time or the resource?
Absolutely. So it definitely takes time, but what you can do and what I did is you integrate it with every subject. So I say, like, I stopped all of our, you know, regular reading and writing exercises, but with everything that we did, we were reading articles about the brain and we were writing poetry and we were writing short stories and we were writing short paragraphs and short essays about various topics related to the brain and neuroplasticity and neurodiversity. There are so many ways to integrate it with the curriculum that it just makes it even richer, because rather than just giving kids a paragraph about something arbitrary to read and answer questions on, it's meaningful and it's integrated into every part of their learning. Math is a little bit trickier to integrate, as I'm sure most educators know, but it's absolutely possible. You could make word problems around this, and you could also try and solve math problems from the perspective of different people. We did that once with the idea of one of our student speakers actually came in and was talking about how hard it was to do timed math tests when he has sensory overload. So things that triggered him were the smells of fruits and different foods and the lights in the classroom. So he would react in ways that most of the kids probably didn't understand. So he simulated that for them. He had them sit on big Lego blocks and he flashed the lights and he sprayed like smelly stuff in the air and he played music. And then he had them fill out a fast 40, like 40 multiplication problems in a row, and see how much they could get done. And it was really interesting for them to see, this is what it's like when he has to do a timed math test, which, you know, we do in so many classrooms. It's just so much harder to do these basic things.
Yeah. What a great exercise in empathizing as well.
Yeah. It was amazing. The kids definitely remembered it.
So tell me a little bit about some of your visitors that you brought into the classroom and the peer-to-peer learning you did with your own students.
Our visitors were all ages, only because I couldn't find a child who could come every single day because they themselves were in school. So we had one young man who has ADHD and learning disabilities talk about what it was like to be in school and how he needed so much help outside of school just to keep on track and to stay on board. We had another man who spoke about what it was like to be gifted and the idea that maybe he was bored in school a lot and his behavior was a result of possible boredom. He was really not challenged in school, and so his behavior got pretty bad. The most impactful visitor that I think we had in the class was a little boy who was autistic. He really gave the kids an idea of what it was like to be him. He called it walking in my shoes, and it was every part of his day, his social interactions and learning and eating, and everything he experienced was just a little bit different than what a neurotypical kid would experience. And it really resonated with the kids, I think, so much because he was so close to them in age. He was in grade 4 and they were in grade 2. And they could see in so many ways they were so similar, but things were just a little more difficult or just a little bit different for him.
Did he give examples? Did he do a similar exercise like your other student?
He's the one who did the simulation. And even what was interesting was we talked about, like, before he came into the class, the things that we had to get ready for him. So we had to make sure that there were no open lunch boxes in the classroom, that definitely nobody had eaten a banana that day, or there was a banana peel in the garbage because he could smell it a mile away. And that was a trigger for him. One other thing that he always makes sure of is that there's none of those like cats where the arm waves automatically, because that, I'm not sure why, but that was a trigger for him and could possibly result in a meltdown or something like that. So, you know, his teachers and his mom, who was amazing, made sure that before he even came to the classroom, we had to get these things ready. So even just the fact that he needed his environment controlled so much was kind of alarming for the kids. Like, they didn't take that any of that into consideration, because they could walk into any room without thinking twice about it. What I try to do is that we all have a little bit of these, like some of us are more sensitive to certain smells or certain lights. Like, we all have that, but some of it is just heightened. So that is really what we're trying to communicate, is that we're all neurodiverse, but for this little boy, it was just a little more extreme.
Yeah. And I think the age, as you've said, like, there's no age is too early to start getting kids to think about other people's experiences through life. Right. And this kind of training at a young age would make, you know, better leaders, better employers, better colleagues in so many ways, to just be aware of other people's differences around you. And we're doing it all the time with color and with sexuality. And yet we are not seeing it in the same way in terms of what's going on inside people.
Right. Absolutely. I think part of that is that the neurodiverse, not that they can't advocate for themselves, but they, not all of them can advocate for themselves as well as perhaps people who identify as different genders or outside of the gender, a typical gender, or are minorities in any ways. Like, because the brain is involved, some often it's the ability to communicate. So that really impacts the ability to speak out and advocate for yourself. Although not always. There's amazing, amazing kids and adults doing amazing work who are neurologically diverse.
Of course. So what impact did you see this having on the kids? And what impact do you hope to have as you go out and spread this around Toronto schools?
The impact was immediate, in that kids were just more empathetic towards one another and finally understood what I kept saying, and that everybody gets what they need, not everybody gets the same thing. They understood the difference between equity and equality. And, you know, they stopped throwing out the word fair and unfair all the time, which is huge. I was hearing it every day. That's so unfair. How come they get that? How come I don't get that? How come they get to stay in at recess and I don't get to stay in at recess? Which in Canada is a thing, because it's so cold out, the kids want to stay in.
Right.
You might not relate. So that was the first thing. And the second thing was just seeing the kids, and this was really the reason we did it, having a little more patience, and then being able to actually develop real friendships with the kids who were on the spectrum or had other neurodiversities. They needed to give them enough of a chance to get to know them so that they could have time to develop those friendships. It just wasn't happening, because they just felt like there was some sort of injustice. So the friendship started, and that was the point of it, for the kids to be friends with everybody.
So how does this grow beyond Toronto? What are your plans for the future?
Ooh, so I mean, I'm just starting in Toronto. So first, I'd like to just hit my city. But ideally, I think one day what I would love to do is build a curriculum that teachers can take themselves, that I don't need to go into each class and teach, but they can do their own and integrate into whatever they're currently teaching. There's actually one organization that I love called the Nora Project, and they do kind of exactly what I want to be doing in Chicago schools, not necessarily with kids with invisible differences or neurodiversities, but just kids with disabilities of all types.
And Nora Project, as in N-O-R-A?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they teach teachers a curriculum, and these teachers implement the curriculum, and it's a year-long program, which I think is the best way to really do this. And that's one thing that when I come into a school, I definitely hope to do a workshop, but then in the end, I leave teachers with the tools to continue the work, because you can't make real change in 4 hours. Teachers need to buy in. It needs to be a change in culture sometimes, mm-hmm. or just reminders, daily reminders, like, make sure if you see somebody on the playground who's alone, invite them to play, or make sure to give your friends space when they need space. It's really a change in how we think, and it's a change in our language. So one day I would love to be able to just have a curriculum that teachers do on their own.
The idea of a curriculum that speaks to brain-based learning, based on research on neuroplasticity, has been around for a few years already. We're seeing the advent of something called neuroeducation, an interdisciplinary branch of neuroscience and pedagogy that will play a key role in the future of education, with curricula based not just on teaching subjects, but on preparing students' brains for learning. Key to this would be understanding how a brain develops and how that changes the way that we'll teach, parent, and help kids to grow and develop. This can already be seen in some preschools in the Montessori, Waldorf, and Reggio Emilia schools of thought, but also in language immersion programs.
So if people, so let's say we have, you know, listeners maybe from other parts of the world and they're interested in finding out more, where should they start?
Finding out more about what I'm doing?
Yes.
So I guess first I would say to go to my website, which is graymattersworkshops.com, gray with an E, not an A. The program is there, and then you can get in touch with me through the website. And I'd love if there are any teachers interested in doing this or bringing this to their school or learning more about it, please get in touch, because I mean, the more teachers we can get doing this, the better it'll be.
Absolutely. Do you have any styles of education that you particularly hold up as great examples, or any kind of other projects that inspire you? Earlier, you were talking to me about Reggio Emilia.
I've always had a fascination with Reggio Emilia and a little bit Montessori, although I don't know as much about it as a philosophy, mostly because both Reggio and Montessori use classroom spaces, like use the environment. They consider that one of the teachers, and there's so much thought that goes into the classroom space. And that's another thing that I hope to work on one day with teachers, is creating spaces that are set up to support our students.
Right. Because so triggered students need a different space, presumably, right? So if you're going to teach that we learn about other people's differences, then we need to also adapt.
Absolutely. And teachers hate to give up like their rainbow garlands and their bulletin boards and the colors everywhere. And Pinterest, I believe, has only made that worse. It's like this competition to get the flashiest door in your classroom. But the truth is that that doesn't support learning, and that doesn't support a calm and safe environment necessarily. Anything that helps our most vulnerable or our highest needs learners will help all the kids. So I tell teachers, when you think of like the most relaxing place, it's so often it's a place in nature, or it's somewhere like a spa or an art gallery. It's often, you know, it's minimalist. It has nature. It has soft sound, sometimes music, but nothing overwhelming. And those are the spaces that we should be setting up school like that. But they're not. They're loud because kids themselves bring in noise and color. So we shouldn't have the noise and color before they even show up.
I think, have you heard of the Green Schools movement?
No.
So there's a couple of schools, one in Bali and one just is opening in New Zealand. And they do exactly that. I mean, it's a school that teaches sustainability, but also the spaces are all natural materials. And there's a lot of gardening and a lot of time spent outdoors by the kids. And I just think how fantastic that would be.
Yeah,
in line with what you're saying. Yeah. So it is happening slowly. And I'm hopeful that people will connect with you if they have other schools that are in need of some of this training, have a few of the other ideas that are going well.
The other thing that I guess I would mention in terms of, it's obviously not purely an educational approach, but the idea of mindfulness, I think, is expanding in so many fields, particularly in education. And I think it's amazing and so important. I had a teacher in Teachers College who introduced mindfulness to me, and I always use it with my students. And the more I learned about the brain, the more I realized that it is one of the best things we could do for kids. So I think all of this can be taught in conjunction with teaching kids mindfulness and how to stop and focus and do things like name their emotions. And, you know, it all fits in with neuroplasticity.
Right. Have you thought about that? Have you thought about doing anything in line with a mindfulness project in schools?
I have done in my own class. We do a lot of work in mindfulness, and with the teachers in my schools, I've been lucky enough to offer professional development and connecting mindfulness to different things, and just teaching teachers to do it for themselves, because teachers are super stressed and it's a hard job. And I think mindfulness would benefit teachers personally. But no, I wouldn't do mindfulness, because I honestly think there's just some amazing experts out there, and I'm just on the beginning of that journey. So I don't think I'm expert enough to do that. But I definitely integrate it into my lessons. From what I know, we do small meditations and moments of quiet and paying attention to our bodies and our feelings. Yeah, it's all integrated for sure.
That's a great start. And I can definitely see this growing and connecting with other schools of thought or other people who are trying to do similar things, but in different ways. So
right.
We'll keep following what happens when it grows beyond Toronto. Yeah. I wanted to go back to that thing about parents. You had a fantastic answer last time about parents who are noticing maybe that their child is different, but they're scared to declare it or they don't want to accept it. You, as a former grade two teacher, said you spoke to parents who wished they had identified and gotten accommodations in place earlier. Why would you recommend that that's something that a parent who maybe is frightened or knows that their child is learning differently, what would you say to them?
Well, what I try to explain to parents is that having a label on something does not make it more or less true. If your child is struggling, they are struggling, whether it's called ADHD or dyslexia or a learning disability, it doesn't really matter what it's called. And there's a stigma to that. And I appreciate that's hard for parents. But once you do have a name to it, then you get access to the resources. And the truth is that in the school system, sometimes you need to have a label in order to get that. So if you want your child to get extra time or one-on-one support or have their tests scrubbed for them, you can't just ask for it because teachers don't have enough time. So they need to have usually a psychoeducational assessment. And in Canada, we call it an individualized education plan, an IEP. You need to have these things written down and formalized so that every teacher is required to do these things, because there are some amazing teachers out there who will go above and beyond for any kid, whether they have a diagnosis or a label or not. But you also have teachers who won't. And in order for your child to get all the support they can possibly get, it needs to be diagnosed or it needs to be named or explained.
Identified in some way.
Identified, that's the word, thank you. Yeah. And the earlier the better, because you know early intervention is key in everything. You know, mm-hmm. if your kid is struggling to read in grade one, okay, in grade two, and in grade three, then you know you have a problem and you need extra support. So yeah, I always tell parents that get it done. It's very possible that a psychoeducational assessment will come up that like, you know, nothing is actually wrong with your child. They just need a little bit more time, or they just, you know, maybe they just need to sit at the front of the class. Like, you won't necessarily get a diagnosis, but mm-hmm. it definitely can't hurt. And having a name on something won't change the reality of their situation.
Right. And I think that's really important when you hear, you know, I just don't want my child to be labeled, as a way of avoiding that. Then I think, you know, the label, as you say, doesn't create a different outcome necessarily.
Right. Right. And if anything, it creates more patience and empathy. You know, if I have a student who is just yelling out every day, that is really frustrating as a teacher. But if I know they have impulse control issues, then I have more patience for them. And I maybe won't send them out in the hall, but I'll give them a lot more chances and a lot more strategies to help deal with that. Because we're human. And sometimes when you have a kid who calls out all the time, it's frustrating and it's hard. So it's a good reminder for teachers that not everything is within the kid's control, but parents need to help us out a little bit and get their children identified or find out what they need.
Shira, like many other educators I've met so far on this podcast, clearly saw a need for a piece that was missing from her own educational context, and so she went ahead and created it. I applaud her initiative, not just because she may well create a program that will drive the Ontario curriculum forward by exposing a gap, but also because she's working to create a more equitable world for children like her own daughter, for whom their neurological challenge will make it difficult for them to have friends who understand their challenges. Thinking about what Shira and I had talked about with labels and diagnoses, patience and empathy in the classroom, I spoke to Sarah Klingstedt, a Finnish clinical psychologist specialised in contextual behavioural science. Sarah works with psychology in educational settings, with a specialisation normally in higher education, but she also worked as a primary school psychologist in Finland. I asked her about what teachers can do to make sure that they inform themselves and are also trusted with their experience of students in the classroom.
Teachers spend such a lot of time with these kids, and they have a unique insight into seeing also the differences between kids in a way that parents maybe aren't able to unless they have a really big amounts of children at home or are in
touch.
Spend
a lot of time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And also teachers over the years gain a lot of experience with a lot of different children. So they get a lot of expertise and just through their lived experience, of course, but they can also inform themselves. They can read up, they can study and learn about these different diverse ways that children can have different challenges in school. And then of course, there's also the aspect of funding and having this included in teacher training so that it's not like just down to passionate teachers wanting to do everything they can for their students, but actually the state, the municipality is taking responsibility for making sure that each child has the best opportunities to succeed in school. Including this content in teacher training is extremely important. And then, of course, as well, seeing to that there is funding for school psychologists, for neuropsychological resources as well.
What would you say to any teachers then who do have a student in their classroom who they know has been formally assessed? What are the ways that they could then address the way that they are with that child and make sure that they're also giving the best once they do know that that child has a different set of needs from what they had previously thought?
It can be very helpful for teachers to practice something that's called psychological flexibility. When it comes to diagnosis, it's both important to not over-label and not under-label, right? So if we are over-labeling, we're basically treating children like small jam jars and just putting this very easy and convenient kind of label on them, like this child is attention-seeking, when maybe we could also think of this child as attention-needing. Of course, it's also not helpful if we're under-labeling children and not giving them the diagnosis when it is actually needed or would be very helpful for them. If a child does not get a diagnosis when needed, they will not get the resources to get help either. And it's good to remember that diagnoses are just, they're really just tools. So sometimes parents especially can get a bit scared of having a child diagnosed, but it's really important to remember that it's really just a tool for getting to the resources that the child needs. And a diagnosis is not the life sentence. It's not, it is just a description of what is happening at a certain time in a person's life. And oftentimes diagnoses can change in the future, or they will not be needed in the future anymore when needs and situations change.
And you said something really interesting earlier about teachers being able to recognize their own responses and their own storytelling about whatever is going on with a child in their class. And I think it's important because Shira was saying it helps her to know that a child has a different set of needs. She can then change her behaviours accordingly and make sure that she's giving her full attention, time and patience to that student. What are some things that you've noticed that help with that kind of framing of a different mindset or a growth mindset for teachers?
Yeah. I would summarise it into saying that when you as a teacher take a curious, open and warm mindset towards the children in your class, you are far more likely to actually see the children as they are instead of how you think they are or how you think they should be.
That curious, open and warm mindset is one that all of the educators I've met so far share. And if we start with that, it seems even in a place of uncertainty, we can allow each child the space and care that they deserve, special educational needs or otherwise. For more information on Grey Matters and the workshops that Shira has created, or to reach out for collaboration, you can visit www.greymattersworkshops.com. She's also on Instagram as Grey Matters Workshops. In episode 5, I'll be talking to Ben Fugel and Tim Milner, two educators who were friends, who both find themselves in an atypical teaching and learning context, and who are both part of a group working to develop OSERAS, a new kind of school that has paired everything back to two essential questions. What is school, and what should school be for? Thanks so much for tuning in. See you next time. You can stay up to date on Pilot Ed by following us on Instagram and Facebook at The Pilot Ed Podcast, or you can say hi on Twitter, just at The Pilot Ed. Thanks for tuning in.